How can we envision the sweeping changes to entire landscapes?
Ownership of commons, the air, soils, water, biological diversity.
Cultural diversity is as critical as biological
disorientation. In this epic struggle to preserve a habitable
planet, that is the only thing which is sustainable.
The
place that you love is now under siege.
Deregulated commerce is becoming a threat to the life on this planet.
These are system problems.
Our humanity is at
stake. We shouldn't ask whether we can survive.
These are existential questions as much as they are systemic questions.
Action informed by knowledge of place.
You're listening to the Schumacher Conversations, a series of lively discussions featuring some of the foremost voices in the movement for a new economics. The conversations engage prominent E.F. Schumacher speakers as they reflect on past lectures and their enduring relevance given current economic, social, and ecological realities.
Any public program to preserve land or produce food is hopeless if it does not tend to right the balance between numbers of people and acres of land and to encourage long-term stable connections between families and small farms.
Let's have a look at it.
Helena Norberg Hodge and Richard Heinberg engaged in the following Schumacher conversation on July 16th, 2020.
Hello, everybody. My name is Matt Stinchcomb. I have the honor of serving as the board chair at the Schumacher Center for New Economics, and I'm very excited to be here this evening with Helena Norberg Hodge and Richard Heinberg. Helena is the founder and director of the Local Futures and the International Society for Ecology and Culture and the International Alliance for Localization. She is also a founding member of the International Commission on the Future of Food and Agriculture, the International Forum on Globalization, and the Global Ecovillage Network. Richard Heinberg is the senior fellow of the Post Carbon Institute and is regarded as one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current global reliance on fossil fuels. Richard is also an author, educator, editor, and lecturer, and has spoken widely on energy and climate issues to audiences in 14 countries, addressing policymakers at many levels, from local city officials to members of the European Parliament. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you. We're very honored to have you with us today. I wanted to talk a little bit about the lectures you both gave as part of the Schumacher Center lecture series. Helena, yours was in 1996, and it's entitled Moving Toward Community, From Global Dependence to Local Interdependence. And Richard, in 2006, you gave a lecture called 50 Million Farmers, outlining a re-ruralization program. Both lectures are really fascinating. I highly recommend that everybody check them out, the contents of which are available to read online, or you can order a pamphlet from Schumacher. But I thought we'd start with you, Helena, if you don't mind, and just ask you to revisit the lecture that you gave then, and maybe summarize some of the key points for the audience today. And what, if anything, would you change, or how have your thoughts changed, especially in the context of the global pandemic and everything that's happening, unfolding in the world right now?
Well, I guess my thinking hasn't changed very much, but I feel both more hopeful and in some ways more alarmed, because I was talking in 96 about the urgent need to shift away from an economic path that was increasing the distance between production and consumption. At every step of the way, it was handing over more and more power to unaccountable banks and corporations. And it was a process called globalization. And so having for a long time, from the mid-70s, very inspired by Schumacher, I must say, I had been a proponent of what I call decentralization. But as the corporate world invented the term globalization for their deregulating global path, I started using the term localization as a systemic alternative to that path, you know, encouraging the idea that we must do everything we can to essentially build up more self-reliant local, regional, and national economies and that this was absolutely essential in order to reduce energy consumption, incredible waste in terms of infrastructure buildup that was, you know, transforming the world in very negative ways, reducing the amounts of plastic for packaging and so on. So this idea of localizing, you know, is very common sense, as you know. It's what Schumacher had been an advocate for and what you're an advocate for and what Richard's been doing for all these years. But I guess the way I would also just to add that I had witnessed, because I had been deeply embedded in a traditional culture called Ladakh in West Tibet, but it's a part of Tibet that belongs politically to India. And I had ended up there in the mid-70s by chance as a linguist helping to make a film and fallen completely in love with the most joyous, vital people I had ever encountered. And I ended up staying at first to work on the language. I did a dictionary and helped to write down the spoken language, which hadn't been written down before. But all the time as I was doing this, I was just falling more in love with these people and found them to be the most peaceful, the most joyous, the most vital, healthy people I had ever encountered. And I saw that they had been sealed off from both colonialism and development. And I think it's very important that they've been sealed off from the former as well as the later process of so-called development, because they actually were still building their own houses out of their own material, weaving their own clothes out of the wool of their own animals. They were growing their own food and, you know, trading regionally. And they worked a fraction of the time that we do. I had an incredible amount of time for celebration, for song, music, and dance, and so on. And I later on was invited to work in Bhutan as well and experienced a very similar situation from the mid-80s to the late 80s. And having been embedded there and then gone back to the West every year to try to alert people to the process of development as being destructive, and then later on warning about globalization, I think I had an unusual bird's eye view of just how destructive this globalizing process is. Because what was happening from the mid-80s onward in particular was that giant industries and big business were moving to the so-called poor countries of the world, because that's where they would find the cheapest labor. So they're uprooting industries from the West to go there. And when people protested in the West, they were told they were being selfish. This was a way to raise the standard of living in the so-called global South. But I was witnessing firsthand and later on collaborating with networks of people throughout the non-Western world. And we were all completely in unison about trying to warn of this dangerous effect. And one of those groups was Via Campesina, one of the biggest social movements in the world, with now about, well, between 200 and 300 million small farmers who've been trying to raise awareness about the disastrous effect on small-scale agriculture of this process. So what I would update now from all that is that I'm thrilled to report that a localization movement is emerging across the world. We have been collaborating with a rural reconstruction movement in China that has made some headway in countering the dominant path. The dominant path of globalization is directly linked to an agenda which will urbanize 100% of the global population. And just recently, a high-level advisor to the Treasury in England came up with this long report showing how agriculture only contributes 1% to GDP. So let's stop farming in England. Why are we farming? Let's be like Singapore and import all our food. Now, the lack of responsibility there, the idea that, you know, we're not going to bother farming, but over there somewhere, there'll be some poor people who'll be willing to farm. The lack of awareness about that unnecessary transport, packaging, and what that does to the emissions. What I find remarkable is that these advisors, I've met many of them. I've spoken at the European Union and, you know, at the World Bank and at the IMF. And I see that these are good people. And so for me, the biggest issue today is really the blindness that underpins this trajectory of a vast global economic system that very few people are stepping back to really look at. And we're finding that the big vested interests don't want us to see it. So it's also becoming more and more difficult to get the statistics. But what we do have is import and export of identical products, particularly food products. Every person on the planet needs food every day, and ideally it should be fresh. And to have a system where our government policies are separating us further and further from the source of that food is, of course, insanity. But it's going on and it's escalating. However, as I said, I started saying before, I'm, you know, going round and round, as is my tendency. The localization movement is growing around the world. And so when I spoke to you in 96, there wasn't nearly as much evidence for the remarkable benefits of strengthening, renewing, or creating a new, you know, local economies. But now we've got a wealth of information and experience from around the world. And so when you add that to the evidence from more traditional self-reliant cultures, particularly indigenous cultures, and the evidence we have there, then you have a very, very strong argument and, as I say, evidence for the multiple benefits. We see a profound healing that happens as people start connecting deeply to community. And we actually see around the world, and actually particularly now in the Western world, with the evidence of more and more trauma that we've undergone, basically because of being uprooted from the land and from community, people are recognizing more and more that the effective therapies have to do with reconnection, deep heart-to-heart human reconnection, actually deep community building, and accompanied by connection to nature, to life, to animals. There are countless therapies that are proving themselves to be effective precisely because that's their focus, that reconnection to others and to nature. Now, in the localization movement, we're talking about building the structural vessel, the vehicle, whereby we can live in that way, where we can have more accountable, visible relationships to the people, to the nature, to the animals that we make use of to meet our basic needs. And it's showing that with that accountability and visibility grows a sense of, first of all, common sense. You could never have GDP measurement in a regional economy. It'd be impossible for people to agree, oh, we've just cut down every tree on the mountainside. Progress. Wow, that's a great accomplishment. Not possible. We've dumped toxic waste into our stream, so it's all polluted and everyone has to buy the water in bottles. Progress. GDP has gone up. Impossible. When you're looking at more visible, accountable structures, you're talking about feedback loops that come back and keep you sane, keep you humble. So it's a profoundly far more important process than we realize. It's really about becoming human again. It's about becoming whole again. It's about becoming strong again, about becoming healthier again, about having a sense of meaning. And so there, as most listeners will probably know, you know, there's a whole range of activities that support this process of rebuilding community and connection to the parts of nature we depend on. There's a absolutely central, most important part of it is the local food movement worldwide that I'm so thrilled to have helped to contribute to and to get feedback from virtually on a daily basis. I get as much good news in my inbox as I get horrible news of what the dominant path is about to do or doing. And so it is really important that people become more actively aware of this sort of new set of lenses through which to view the world and actively seek out that evidence of the multiple benefits of localizing. And there are, you know, there are business alliances, there are local finance initiatives, there are local currencies, there are local energy schemes, all of them pointing in this direction of health and vitality. And it's particularly interesting, too, that we're seeing that in terms of political change, more sensible policies and a listening ear comes from local governments, from mayors of cities. We work particularly closely in Korea and also with the mayor of Seoul. And it's wonderful to see the change in thinking and also local councils and smaller regional governments. In Canada, in Ontario, the regional government has done a lot to support local food and diversified, local food as diversifying in order to create real food for real people, not just a farmer's market to put some nice, labels on things to be sold to tourists or to be exported. So there's a lot of thinking, I think, that needs to be done to look at how we support genuinely human scale, genuinely circular economies. And we need to be very aware that the concept of circular economy is being used by big business for something completely different to justify the use of toxic waste and the production of toxic materials that we really should just stop producing. So yeah, what I can report after 96 is that there is a flowering and a proliferation of local initiatives worldwide. I'd like to mention to people that we try to put together in this COVID period a program where we try to present as much of that from around the world that we could manage to pull together in a very short time. And I apologize that the Schumacher Center wasn't included, because it should be, because we were identifying colleagues around the world, and we were also trying to identify some famous people like Russell Brand and Noam Chomsky and the Dalai Lama to support this, because we realize that too few people know about this quiet movement. Quiet because the media doesn't pick it up, because it's too much of a threat to a corporate-led media. So we put together this program, and we launched what we call World Localization Day. And that was on June 21st. And I urge people to come to our website to see this. It's a more than 4-hour program. And Richard is in it, and many other local colleagues from around the world. So I think that's all. I'd like to at some point also come back a bit to that after COVID, there's been a very clear call for community and food and an amazing, wonderful, situation all around the world where you can't buy seedlings, you can't buy seeds, because everybody's buying them. And I hope everybody's heard about the wonderful evidence, too, of using bicycles. So all these bicycle shops and people who repair and sell bicycles have been completely overwhelmed with demand. And so there's been basically a huge demand for localization. But at the same time, from big business has come huge pressure to go in exactly the opposite direction, into the arms of robots, into digital currencies, which is the absolute leap into the arms of a centralized global system. And I think a type of techno-fascism that we have to be really aware of. Highly energy intensive, trawling seabeds for more minerals, creating mountains of electronic toxic waste dumped in poor countries out of sight. So the out of sight side of this internet world and the internet of things, the effect of 5G and the romanticization of robots, that's the other side of the coin that we need to be raising awareness about urgently.
Thank you for that. That's I agree with everything you're saying. And, it is such an interesting moment right now. Just one little bit of, I guess, another little flowering of hope about the technology piece. My kids were, essentially transitioned to Zoom school through their school. And we were very hesitant and reluctant. And it was actually our kids themselves who said, we don't want to be online anymore. And we just pulled them out, and that was really encouraging, because you know, on some level, the screens are like the most enticing thing, the technology, and even they've rejected it. And that's, you know, I've been seeing that, you know, this is presenting us with an opportunity to connect more to place, more to our families, maybe harder to connect to our communities in person, of course, which is one of the challenges. But I do see a general questioning of things that's coming out of the coronavirus. And I'm curious, just for you, Helena, before we get Richard's thoughts on what you shared. You know, you mentioned the lack of awareness of, you know, the dominant paradigms that are, you know, running things in this world. How do you think, or in what ways do you think the coronavirus could serve as an opportunity to become more aware, to become more awake? And do you see that happening?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think for one thing, you know, I think a lot of people have seen that it's been quite beneficial to have a bit of a pause. For a lot of people, it's been so welcome to be able to slow down a bit. And that's given people also more of an opportunity to think things over. And as I said, they discovered this great thirst for connection. And interestingly enough, I think I'm hearing from a lot of people who say they never even knew the names of their neighbors, and now they do. You know, there's been this spontaneous arising of self-help groups that have been, you know, a great testimony again to the essential goodwill of human beings, which is another very important part of the two narratives, that the dominant narrative taking us into the arms and romanticizing robot is very much linked to this message that human beings are innately greedy and look at them. They didn't even listen to us when we told them about climate change, they haven't done anything to change. No discussion at all about what government has been doing with big business to massively increase emissions by increasing the distances of our daily food, you know, that our daily food travel. So I think now there has been a bit of a pause, and to some extent, this sort of life on the web, to some extent, has been, those airwaves have been filled with messages like ours. So we're suddenly seeing a big increase in interest in what we've been saying. And I even saw them touching, you know, in the New York Times on the idea that, oh, governments may not be so inclined to want to be dependent on goods from the other side of the world. So there's been a bit of a questioning of the dependence on the global economy. But I think this techno-economic dependence is what we really have to be very careful of. So I see people have taken a pause. There's a thirst for more connection to place, to life, to others. And yeah, I think now I think all of us have to realize how much time, resources, energy, funding we need to spend on getting the word out, a bigger picture. So I call it big picture activism. For a long time, I've been trying to say that there's been, you know, the biggest problem we face is the lack of awareness. And it was this system, you know, this economic system is so far removed. And then its impact in creating divisiveness, in increasing racism, you know, it was from the outset, this system was racist, very obviously and visibly so. It was misogynist, racist, anti-nature. And that system is everywhere in the world, increasing fear and insecurity. And I just want to add that, despite those pressures on people, terrible time pressures, terrible fear and insecurity, there is a cultural mainstream shift towards valuing women, towards deepening respect for indigenous culture. And now with Black Lives Matter, another huge show of real care and concern. So there is a mainstream cultural shift that's very positive. There's got to include that economic shift, that techno-economic shift. I have to be very careful I don't talk too much.
Well, no, thank you. It's all great. Richard, love to just invite your feedback or comments or questions for Helena, and then we can move into your lecture too.
Sure. Well, first of all, hi, everybody. And happy to, especially to be here with Helena. We've been working together in one way or another since the early 90s.
Yeah.
And so everything you say, as always, I agree with. And if I have a question, it would be this moment. You know, we're in a bit of a reversal. Global trade is actually down something like 20% over the last 3 or 4 months. I mean, that's absolutely unheard of. It's from an economic perspective, traditional economic perspective, this is earth shaking. This is something we haven't seen since the Great Depression. And of course, most of that, the vast majority actually, is due to the economic fallout of the lockdowns from the coronavirus pandemic. Some of it, however, is actually due to policies of the Trump administration, which has been slapping tariffs on all sorts of things, especially with China. But you know, the line of Trump and his followers is, well, we want to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. So what do you think about that? Is all of this, should we be cheering all of these things, or should we be taking a little bit more of a skeptical perspective? What do you think?
I think definitely we have to take a skeptical perspective. I was asked to review a book about 2 and maybe 3 years ago by, I think, an Oxford economist. I can't remember his name, but it was called something like Shifting from Global to Local. And I was so thrilled. I couldn't believe it, you know, this sort of quite prestigious economist. And the whole thing was about how no ecological bone, you know, in his body. Just, you know, it was all about how great it was that Westinghouse was now coming back from China to manufacture in America with robots. And he was praising Zara, because Zara, this great, huge multinational in clothing, they were actually manufacturing in Spain rather than going all the way to China. I mean, so no, we can't. First of all, I don't believe, I'm not even sure I believe those statistics, because I'm suddenly seeing right here these huge container ships going back and forth. I was very skeptical during COVID. Why didn't we hear more about the fact that food is flown on a daily basis to be processed in China? You know, they fly fish from America, from Norway, from here to China to be processed, deboned, filleted, flying it back again. They fly nuts from Australia to be cracked open, flying back again. This is going on all around the world every day. Why didn't we hear more about that during COVID? I don't know, because we would have been a bit worried about having, in the early stages, especially our food processed in China. And we know that whatever might be done will be done in that selective way, but we're still talking about the system that is extracting wealth to the top. And we're talking about a lack of ecological awareness inside that, both political and economic leadership. So we, from the ground up, we need to be much, much more, yeah, alert and awake. And what we mustn't do is allow what is happening, which is that the corporate world tries to tell people, oh, yeah, yeah, localization, that's what Trump is all about. And we must be very clear. No, Trump is about exactly the opposite of what we're about, because we represent, you know, a profoundly ecological, a profoundly democratic, a profoundly caring and just path forward. So let's not fall for some of these superficial and perhaps selective choices. When he can sell shoes, his daughter's shoes or whatever in China, he'll happily make a deal to do that. It's selective, and it comes from none of those values that I was just mentioning.
Great, thank you. Well, Richard, let's turn to you and revisit your 2006 Schumacher lecture on 50 million farmers. Maybe you could summarize that a little bit and share how you would change it and what's alive for you right now.
Right. Well, my argument back in 2006 was very simply that we have created a food system that is inherently unsustainable. And in order to make it more sustainable, we're going to need a lot more people engaging with food production activities. And it just a, you know, the number 50 million was just sort of pulled out of the air. And that's for the U.S. It's not global, but just for the U.S., I figured, well, if we had 50 million more farmers, we'd be in better shape to deal with what's coming. So what was the basis for that? It was essentially that our current food system is overwhelmingly dependent on fossil fuels. And we have to understand, first of all, what fossil fuels have done for us. You know, back 200 years ago or even 150 years ago, 75, 85, even 90% of the population in most countries worked at farming, worked on the land. And that didn't always look wonderful. There was a lot of poverty, there was disease, there was inequality, and so on. I don't want to try to make it out as some kind of Garden of Eden. Nevertheless, that for better or worse, that changed with the advent of cheap fossil fuels and especially oil, oil-powered tractors and other farm machinery. Fewer and fewer people had to work at agriculture. And so we're down to a situation where now in the U.S., 1% of the population work full-time at farming, something like that. I don't know the exact percentage this year, but it's roughly 1%. And everybody else does other things, you know. So a vast number of people proportionally moved to cities over the last several decades. That's been the source of the trend toward urbanization, which is one of the great demographic social trends of the last 100 years, completely unprecedented in all of previous world history. And it's not just because we invented new machines. That's a simplistic way of looking at it. We invented new machines to take advantage of highly energy-dense materials that we figured out how to extract from the earth and burn in controlled ways, namely coal, oil, and natural gas. So we created the middle class based on fossil fuels, and we created the modern food system based on fossil fuels. It only really works with cheap oil to run tractors and harvesters and combines and seeders, and to transport food ever further distances. So supply chains have grown and grown, as Helena was saying. And that gives us cheaper food, but at what cost? Obviously, there's the cost of burning all of those fossil fuels, which creates climate change. And then there are also hidden costs, the cost of vulnerability. What happens if we no longer have those fossil fuels available to us for some reason? And I spent some time in the talk discussing why that's something we really should be worried about. After all, fossil fuels are depleting non-renewable resources, and we've been extracting them at ever-increasing rates using the low-hanging fruit principle, where we've extracted and burned the highest quality, easiest to access fossil fuels first, and leaving the nasty, dirty, expensive stuff for later. And overwhelmingly, we're seeing that it's across the board, it's later. We're having Chinese are having to dig deeper for their coal, and their coal production, largely as a consequence, has plateaued and started to decline, which is a good thing. The situation has changed considerably since 2006, in that at that time it looked like world oil production was set to peak and decline within just a few years. And indeed, in retrospect, world conventional oil production did reach a maximum around 2005. It's been on an undulating plateau with a general sort of decline since then. But unconventional oil in the form of Canadian tar sands and tight oil produced by hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling here in the U.S. have come to the rescue, mostly U.S. tight oil. And so as a result of that, U.S. oil production has soared, and that has kept world oil prices on a, you know, more or less affordable scale. And maintain the ever increasing march of industrialization and globalization. Now that is coming to an end as we speak. I work with the organization, as you mentioned earlier, Post Carbon Institute. One of the things we do is we do an annual survey of U.S. Natural gas and oil fracking. We purchase the proprietary information on drilling activity and production on a per well basis, and we do a annual report that's quite detailed. And it's been clear to us from the beginning of this that this is a very short-term play. It's basically a Ponzi scheme because the individual wells deplete so rapidly that the only way to keep production growing is just to drill and drill and drill. It's like a treadmill the industry is on. And the more they drill, the higher the decline rates become from existing wells. And at some point, you just can't keep running faster than the conveyor belt. And we're pretty much at that point right now anyway. And then add the coronavirus pandemic and the economic impacts of that with declining global transportation and therefore declining oil demand. And suddenly the global oil business is just in a tailspin. And this is true both for the big oil companies like ExxonMobil and Shell, but especially also for the smaller oil companies that have led the fracking boom. They're going bankrupt one after another. Just yesterday, Chesapeake Energy, which led the whole charge toward fracking, went bankrupt, which was no surprise to us because all of these companies have actually been losing money for the last 10 years, even as they've been increasing production. So chickens are coming home to roost with apologies to my friends, the chickens. The result is world oil production did reach a peak and has been in decline since November 2018. Not many people noticed that because there were so many other things going on. But now we're, from this point on, one way or another, at one rate or another, we're going to see declining world oil production. And that puts in peril our whole industrial food system. We have to transition to something else. So what will that be? The obvious candidate is renewable energy. Well, we'll just build a bunch of solar panels and wind turbines and continue living the way we are. It turns out it's not so simple. It's not so easy. And another area where we've done original research at Post Carbon Institute is on the prospects for a transition to renewable energy. I worked for a year with David Fridley, who's on the energy analysis team at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and we did a pretty thorough review of the prospects for renewable energy transition, which is published as a book, Our Renewable Future, which is available free online. Just Google Our Renewable Future. And our finding was basically that, solar and wind are getting cheaper, batteries are getting cheaper, but to produce as much energy as we're currently using would take an absolutely enormous investment and rate of investment, completely unprecedented in modern history or world history. Further, these energy sources produce electricity, but we only use 20% of our energy in the form of electricity. The other 80% we use in the form of liquid, gaseous, and solid fuels. This is particularly true with transportation, which runs almost entirely on liquid fuels. So that means we have to replace an enormous amount of transport infrastructure, as well as infrastructure in manufacturing, high-heat industrial processes, and so on, in order to get them to run on electricity. That's another enormous investment that society would have to make. So our conclusion at the end of the day was and is that the only way this transition is going to happen is if we just start using a heck of a lot less energy. First of all, it's unlikely that we'll be able to invest enough to produce enough renewable energy in the future to do all the things we're doing right now. And then the rate of investment that would be required is unrealistic. So the only way we get to do that is if we first reduce the amount of energy we're using, and then we can make the transition more readily. I mean, you do the same thing if you're going to solarize your house, if you're going to put PV panels on your roof. It's expensive. It's a big and upfront investment. So what do? You lower your electricity consumption first to make the whole thing more affordable. We've got to do that as a whole society, reduce our energy usage, and particularly in areas that are going to be hard to electrify, like transportation. So what does that mean? Less long-distance transport, less globalization, more local production and consumption, shortened supply chains, which is exactly, of course, what Helena was talking about. And there are, as she is constantly saying, for a very good reason, there are many side benefits to doing this. My point is simply what we're doing now is physically impossible to maintain for much longer. We have to make other plans. What else can I say about that 2006 presentation that's changed? Yeah, some good news since then. There's been a lot of research into something called carbon farming, which is a set of techniques for reintroducing carbon to topsoil, changing our farming techniques, basically. And it mostly translates to using fewer carbon inputs in farming, treating the soil like a living entity rather than this inert stuff into which we pump fertilizers and other chemicals, and doing it on a smaller scale. So that's a very good thing. People are talking about it. The IPCC is talking about it. And of course, the local food movement, the transition initiatives. We at Post Carbon Institute back in 2005, 2006, were starting what we called the Localization Network. And there were over 100 local entities that sprang up to take advantage of whatever insights we were coming up with. Well, we very soon saw that there was this organization that started in Great Britain called the Transition Towns, which was kind of an organizing model for localization that we thought was actually doing a better job of what we were trying to do with our localization network. So we funded the creation of a local or a national hub for the U.S., Transition U.S., which has pioneered or assisted with the flourishing of hundreds of local transition groups across the U.S. There are now organizations of young farmers who are taking up this call for 50 million farmers and finding ways to support other young farmers in doing that. And it's, we have to be honest, it's difficult. Land is expensive, and young people often come to this with, big college debt to pay off. And, buying land and farm equipment on top of that is a big challenge. So we need people who are in my age bracket, who are land owners, to pay attention and see where are the young farmers who could benefit from us making land available. I don't happen to be a big landowner myself, but the big landowners are generally in my age group, is what I'm saying, and they need to be making acreage available to young farmers who are enthusiastic about this as a not a job, but as a career, as a way of life. Let's see, last points. maybe I've said everything I need to say, because we did touch on this point of global trade having declined by 20% in the last few months. And really, this is creating, you know, both danger and opportunity. The danger is that our food system could be becoming unstable, particularly for people in the global South and in low-income environments. I wrote a piece just a couple of months ago, which is called Fraying Food System, Our Next Crisis. And, you know, again, you can find that on the web. But I talk about all of the reasons why the coronavirus pandemic is making it harder on food producers, people who work in the fields and in food warehouses and slaughterhouses and so on, who are coming down with the coronavirus because they're working in such close proximity with one another and often with very little protection. They're becoming more vulnerable. People who depend on cheap food, people who have lost their jobs and can't pay for food. The food system is not working for any of these folks. And so there are real dangers. The opportunities, on the other hand, are, you know, the shrinking supply chains and the fact that there's now a light shining on a lot of these issues that have been overlooked for far too long. The welfare of, they're called essential workers now, the people who are growing our food and distributing it for us. Well, what about these essential workers, and what conditions are they working in, and how do we make sure that our local farmers are going to be there for us? These are really important questions. So that's enough for me for right now.
Great. Thank you so much. Helena, do you have any thoughts or comments on what Richard shared?
I do. I would first of all question or want us to look differently at what happened in agriculture. From my point of view, we need to understand that this economic system, as I said, started with slavery, genocide, pretty nasty values and nasty ways of dealing with people. So once you had landowners that had enslaved people on huge cotton plantations or tea plantations, or, you know, driven people away from the more human scale structures, the decentralized, you know, the smaller towns in England, that we know very little about what happened before the enclosures. But, you know, they were driven off, you know, into London to become cheap labor for this industry that was, you know, having cotton slaves on the other side of the world. Now, once you had farming of that kind, vast monocultures and people sort of enslaved, then it looked like bringing in fossil fuels and the machinery, you know, was great progress. Right. But I'm of the conviction that if we studied, and there's quite a lot of evidence from Asia also, if we study going back thousands of years, we have actually had settled agriculture that worked really well. Maybe not perfectly and maybe no paradise, but smaller scale diversified farms linked to more local economies that really worked well for thousands of years. And then for me, the new local food movement, where young people are actually actively wanting to go back to the land and where they're able to be linked to markets closer to the farm, is really working quite well. But what makes it so difficult is the policies, and we have to look at those holistically. Now, the policies and the propaganda, you know, you were saying that it did make food cheaper. I'm questioning that. With modern industrial agriculture, we've been hearing, oh, you know, look at how much you paid for food 20, 30, 40 years ago. But they're talking about as proportion of disposable income. What's happened as a consequence of these overall policies that have driven people off the land into cities is that house prices have shot up exponentially. So as a proportion of your disposable income, you are paying less for food today. But if you were to actually be able, and this is where I think we could use billions of dollars for our think tanks, there's never been proper money put into the sort of think tanks we need to really go back, because I'm saying this based on, you know, common sense. I'm not saying it based on massive research, but certainly if you were to look at how many hours you have to work to put any kind of decent food on the table, and even supermarket food, which is not so decent, probably you would find that we are not, the food is not cheaper. But what's happened is that, you know, that we've been led to believe that there is some kind of efficiency there, and that, yeah, we have to do this because poor people need cheap food. Actually, it's all been about extraction of wealth, and it's been about, you know, as I say, you know, we know that in the average family, even 30 years ago, both mother and father in the little nuclear family didn't have to work just to stay in place. So in that way, I would love to, you know, keep pushing everyone in the West more to start really looking at how hard this has been, how, you know, we are running faster and faster just to stay in place, to keep a roof over our head, to have that education, to have the health care. Let's look at the actual material poverty that has been on the increase, even in the middle class. But then let's also spell out the spiritual poverty of increasing alienation, loneliness, living alone, the epidemics of depression and anxiety among our young people. I think it's a very important part of the message, not to say that, yes, of course, there were certain comforts and there's been certain advantages for the middle class.
For some people, yes.
Yeah, for some people, but for the majority, really not. And it's, and what works in our favor is that the winners right now is a smaller and smaller and smaller number. You know, they have more and more fake money behind their name, which is now zeros on an electronic screen. It's been completely deregulated from gold and from any kind of standard. So it's not real wealth. So I feel we are the fools if we don't expose this sort of emperor's clothes, make-believe wealth that is pushing people to run, the majority, 99%, to run faster and faster and faster just to stay in place, if they're lucky. But more and more people are falling off, you know. So that's one thing, I think, slight difference in terms of what you said. And also about, you know, the drudgery earlier, like I say, I think it was mostly linked to that inequitable system, but not only. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that everything was paradise before the modern industrial economy, but by and large, it's been pretty destructive from the outset, and it's been marketed to the sort of middle classes and the industrial urban population as, oh, you're so lucky, you have everything. Look at those poor people over there. They have nothing, they have nothing. And, you know, I've been trying to point out forever that a lot of the people they're pointing at have extended intergenerational community. They have plenty of time. They all know how to play music, sing and dance together. Wait a minute, you know. But as I say that, I'm also aware that those poor people over there who don't have anything also do have less and less. They have less and less time because this expansion of this energy-intensive system is also pushing them into urban centers. But what I'd love to also, I also just want to question, I'm very worried about the use of carbon as the metric for climate change. My colleague, Camilla, who's been at all the climate summits for the last 11 years, as a Brazilian representative of NGO movements, because they had that demand, which Bolsonaro is probably going to take away. But so she's been at all the climate summits and she's seen how it's the big business setting the agenda and turning climate change into carbon, a tradable commodity, is very dangerous. And I'd like to encourage everyone to be insisting that when we talk about healthy agriculture, let's not just use the term regenerative, let's use the terms diversified, localized, regenerative food systems and food economies, and insist on being holistic, because I'm seeing and actually talking to some farmers here in Australia who are saying it's great with regen ag, it still allows for the large scale export oriented agriculture. So I think we need to be very, very aware of how easily we can be co-opted.
Mm. Right. Well, something you said toward the beginning of all of that was about the inherent inequality in some of the earlier agricultural practices that were displaced by industrialization, like, you know, plantation slavery. And if I can put on my amateur anthropologist hat, you know, going back 5,000, 6,000 years, it was really field agriculture that largely led to the appearance of the early state societies, which were some of the most unequal, despotic regimes in all of human history. What came before that, though? It was, well, first of all, hunting and gathering, but there was an interval in between, which was various kinds of horticultural production. And if we look at how societies organized themselves around these ways of producing food, it's very clear that, you know, as when we were hunters and gatherers, we tended to live in small groups that were pretty egalitarian. You know, men had their secret societies, but women had their secret societies. You know, it wasn't paradise, but the kinds of economic and social inequality that we've gotten used to in the modern world basically didn't exist. Horticultural societies weren't that different in terms of social equity and so on. Many of them are characterized by sort of big man situation where one guy in the village gets esteem from his colleagues by getting them to work harder and produce a surplus. And he gathers up the surplus every year so that he can throw a big party. And everybody goes, hey, what a great guy. He got us to work hard so he could have this terrific party. And, you know, he can't force anybody to do anything. He's not a chief or a king, but, you know, he's the big guy. And then gradually from there, we go on to complex horticulture and chieftain societies. And then we get to agriculture and the beginnings of the really nasty stuff of state societies and slavery and all the rest, which, you know, have continued in different forms right up to the present. What I'm coming to with all of this is that if we really want to get beyond the profound inequalities that are inherent in private property and capitalism and all of these things that so many folks are worried about, and racism, et cetera. Ultimately, I think we're going to have to get back to handling food production differently, because that's where culture comes from. If you want to understand a people's culture, look at how they produce their food. Any anthropologist knows that. So to think that we can produce food in an inherently unsustainable, inequitable way and enjoy a society that's somehow peaceful and equitable and so on, it's not going to happen. We have to start with the roots of culture and how food is produced. And I think ultimately that means going back to something like, you know, most people producing their food on a small scale through something like permaculture gardening. I think the permaculturists actually have it right. You know, that's if we're going to have a future worth looking, you know, worth looking forward to, that's what it's going to look like.
Well, I sort of agree with that, but where I have to be, you know, I have to take a different position just from my experience, is that in Ladakh and Bhutan and, mm-hmm. and Tibet, you know, I was, you know, I lived in Ladakh and worked for 40 years, and in the early years for about half of the year. And there would be anthropologists and academics coming out from the West and insisting on painting this as a feudal, unequal society. They would start projects to make sure that there were also nunneries, not just monasteries for the men, and they had they basically saw it and described it as a feudal society. Now, over the years, as I lived there, I realized that, yes, there was a large number of men who had this big fancy monastery, and there were paintings, and the villagers supported them with their grain. But as I lived there, I realized it was my son, my uncle, my father, sometimes they would go off and decide to be in the monastery. It was family, and they, of course, were happily feeding them for services that they were thought to be providing. I didn't see any trace of the sort of image you have, and you just hear feudal and unequal. And of course, it served as a way of keeping population down over centuries.
Right.
So it's not my
What percentage of the people were actually involved in food production, do you think?
Oh, 99?
Yeah.
99%. And however, those monks who were in the monastery weren't. And so that looked like some great privilege for them. I actually, again, over the years, I interpreted as an advantage for the women who became nuns that they lived at home. Because they actually probably, as women, they were more social creatures and they didn't need to be up on the mountaintop to stay celibate. So it was, you know, in terms of population control, in terms of the overall harmony and overall egalitarian nature of this system, where everybody knew the richest man in the village, everybody knew the monks in the monastery. As I say, they were family. So it's a very, and for me, the idea that in order to come back to a healthy relationship, get more egalitarian and healthier food production, we have to go to hunter-gathering. Now that locks us in a situation where we're not going to make much.
It's not going to happen. No. We would need such a small population. We can't get there from here.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that the, as you say, the permaculture model, but for me, right now, to reach more people, I think we need to include farming and small farmers and build those relationships between city and country. And when we, for this intermediate stage anyway, I agree with you that I think we would happily go back to the majority of people being engaged in food production once we wake up to the joy of it.
Yep.
that's actually a good segue. I've got some questions from the audience here, and one of them is befitting what you were just both sharing. Naomi Klein has been speaking recently about this moment as ripe for picking up ideas lying around, proposals and discourses which, under normal circumstances, would have been considered impossible or out of reach, politically or socially. Yet, are not only seen as reasonable, but are also critically necessary under new circumstances. Examples might include the universal basic income or a Green New Deal. Richard, you mentioned permaculture. That's not really like an old idea that's been lying around, but...
Well, since the 70s anyway.
Yeah. What, in both of your opinions, are some of the most ripe ideas lying around right now that this moment might be the appropriate one to bring them out?
Well, I'll just go first. I wrote a piece on this recently called, what was the exact title? Something about the pandemic and post-growth economic thinking. Because we, right now, basically, we're in a global depression. And so suddenly, economic ideas like universal basic income are starting to appeal to a lot of policymakers, just because they have this huge problem on their hands and they need to solve it. So they're willing to engage in some kinds of heterodox thinking. Hopefully, you know, they'll take some of these ideas seriously and look more deeply into them, because there have been post-growth economic theorists exploring, you know, what happens when we reach the limits to growth, which is inevitable, and how we reorganize society. Universal basic income is just one of those ideas. Moving away from GDP as a measure for the success of economies is absolutely essential. We're, you know, no nation is going to see GDP growth like we had for decades and decades anytime soon. So why shouldn't we be measuring people's quality of life more directly and use that as our measure of success? And, you know, obviously it makes more sense. So, you know, things like gross national happiness, which have been pioneered in Bhutan for many years since the 70s, those are waiting to be picked up off the shelf and applied. And there are other examples like that. But, you know, we have reached, as the title of my 2010 book says, the end of growth. So, hey, you know, what do we do now? It's time to stop fooling ourselves into thinking that somehow we can return to the 1950s as the Trump folks would like us to do, or, you know, the roaring 90s as maybe some of the Democratic politicians would like us to do here in the U.S., and realize that we're in a new moment and we have to completely rethink economic theory and how, what kinds of indicators and mechanisms, institutions we use. So
yeah, I would agree absolutely. Now we have to completely rethink the economy, and I think we're talking about the absolute antithesis to what Ricardo was promoting with comparative advantage. This idea that specializing for export is how you enrich your country or your region is simply something that's gone way, way to an extreme that has then led to the continued increase in wealth of the traders, the globally active deregulated banks, starting already in the 1400s. They were taking advantage of the invisibility of operating globally. There were changes in accounting. There were changes, of course, to fractional reserve banking. So the way money and goods have been handled in the global trading regime has given an advantage to the global players, and the settled players all around the world have suffered as a consequence. We now need to reverse that. So the idea that's lying around waiting to be kicked up and picked up is localization, as far as I'm concerned. It's about strengthening and diversifying local economies with a very clear focus on the basic needs, and food and water, you know, being absolutely the ones we have to focus on. And if we were to change policies to support that, it's remarkable what we could do in a very short time. And I want to alert people to this fabulous film called The Biggest Little Farm, which for me is the most beautiful expression of what can be done in just a short time. And the diversification on the land includes animals, because actually that's a very efficient way of using smaller amounts of resources to gain maximum optimum production. When we diversify in that way, we can massively increase production per unit of land and water. On a crowded planet, that's what we've got to do. In order to make that viable, we must shorten the distances between the farm and the consumers. And so I think there's enormous opportunity to really shift direction, but it will need the pressure and vision for meaningful policy change. I'm afraid that there are two Green New Deals out there. One of them trying desperately to create a continued collaboration between Silicon Valley, Wall Street, and the Pentagon in a race to Mars to look for more scarce resources and fight over them. And it is continuing with urbanization and globalization and trying to use renewables, but also nuclear, new forms of nuclear to power the ships that are meant to keep carrying things back and forth. And I think we need to be very strong and clear about what kind of Green New Deal we want. And so I love Richard's work spelling out that we need to use less energy. And what I want, you know, what I'm trying to say very strongly with that is actually with less energy, we're going to be much healthier, much happier. And, you know, there are, again, there's a whole wealth of information that can point in that direction. With the pandemics, it's so clear that it's this animal factories that are the most evil, the most cruel, and the most toxic, and the most unhealthy for humans and for the animals and the planet. So, yeah, we have a lot of strong evidence now to encourage a shift to diversification and localization.
We're coming close to the end of our time. I'll take one more question from the audience and then ask you both for some short closing remarks. But I think you've both spoken to, you know, these dramatic shifts that need to occur in our economic systems. And underpinning all of it, in my mind and in the mind of this questioner, is a consciousness, right? It's the values. It's how we see ourselves in relation to the world. And I'm curious to hear from both of you, what do you think might bring about the shift in consciousness that will be required to transition to a very different way of being, a more connected way, as you might say, Helena? So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm so worried I'm talking too much, but do you want to say it?
Well, actually, Helena, you said something at the very beginning about how the pandemic and the lockdown are, you know, shifting people's lives and perceptions in really profound ways. It's like this global timeout, and suddenly, you know, we're having to think of ourselves not as masters of the universe, but as organisms in an ecosystem. And we have ecosystems inside us, you know, and ecosystems outside of us. And the whole, the program for success is to get them all in harmony with one another rather than, you know, to dominate the whole thing with some kind of mechanistic mindset. More and more people are starting to think that way as a result of, you know, having a little time off and beginning to see things in a different light. Just the fact that normal has been disrupted and discredited, I think, is extremely significant. You know, the normal of consumerism and of the treadmill of growth and globalization, that's been profoundly disrupted, even just within the last couple of months. I think the trend had actually already started before the pandemic, but now with the pandemic has accelerated that dramatically. And there's no going back. It's really clear that, you know, there will be a new normal, hopefully at some point, but we don't know what that's going to look like, but we're not going back to what we thought of as normal before. So it's an enormous creative opportunity. And people are hungry for vision for what that new future could possibly look like. How could we make it more equitable, more sustainable, more ecological, more happy, more beautiful? You know, beauty is really all the way up through evolution. Beauty has played a profound role in the guidance of evolution of species, much more so in many cases than, you know, survival of the fittest has been, you know, the impulse toward why do birds sing? You know, is it just to get that mate? Well, then they, you know, they certainly don't have to sing as much as they do. They sing as much as they do because they realize that they love singing and they love beauty and having beauty in their lives. We're the same way. And particularly where I live in the United States, you know, we have wrung so much of the beauty out of daily life in order to, you know, keep up with that treadmill. Now that we're slowing down, there's a lot to enjoy. So hopefully we can do that.
Yeah, I also... already when I wrote Ancient Futures, which is my book where I looked at this, the difference between this traditional ancient land and community-based culture and the modern industrial world, and I was sort of forced to step back and see this bigger picture, I could already then, when I wrote this, which was in the late 80s, see that there were these trends that I called Ancient Futures micro-trends throughout the industrial world, where people had been shoved away from community, from intergenerational connections with other human beings, away from the land into cities, that they were developing a thirst for connection to the land, for nature, for community. And I was seeing in every area, in every discipline, from theology to psychology to agriculture, eco-theology, eco-literacy, eco-agriculture, as people develop this longing for a healthier relationship with nature and, as I say, also with community. So, and I, as I was saying, in the mainstream culture, we can see that that evolution has taken place. There's been a cultural evolution towards this longing for connection to nature and to community. And you see also in certain hubs around the world where people have moved, they've chosen to step down from the fast-paced, competitive ladder in the big city to just say, no, I want quality of life, moving to smaller cities, wanting their children to have, yes, again, more community and contact with nature. So that's happening, and people clearly want it. What's tragic is that there's not been enough attention to the fact that the economic trajectory, and very structurally linked to energy and technology, has continued in the same direction that it started in colonialism, slavery, and genocide. And there, the concentration, the centralization into unaccountable, blind leadership, where people are still just looking at the numbers of GDP and refusing to recognize the realities of what these policies lead to. So for me, I think the really key thing now is that we, when we talk about consciousness, that we talk not only about that deeper spiritual consciousness, which has been growing, escalating in the Western world, the consciousness that life is one, that everything is fundamentally interdependent in flux and flow. And when we step into that, when we are more in the here and the now, we experience a sense of peace. It has to do with the balance in our brain. I've been working with Ian McGilchrist, who is a very interesting thinker in this area of left-right brain. And he's as concerned and aware as I am of how this shift into urban modernity is actually changing our brain in a very dangerous way, because we're getting locked into the left side of the brain where we are, which is the part of the brain that is about focus in order to grasp and do, but the right side of the brain that is more about that deeper holistic comprehension of the whole and that gives us more peace. That side of the brain is being neglected. So what we need to be conscious of is both the great gift that many spiritual teachings offer us in terms of a more meditative, contemplative way of being, but just as importantly, we need to use the left side of the brain to try to comprehend better, well, left and right, let's say, to comprehend better this techno-economic system that's continuing to take us in the wrong direction very dramatically, and that now threatens to potentially do so in an even more draconian way that ultimately can't work, but it could inflict so much more damage for several decades or whatever to come. And partly because we're allowing that path to be dominated by people, as I said, who are building it on make-believe money. So part of that whole picture of the puzzle of the economy is also to look at who has the right to make the money and for what purpose, how is it going to be distributed. It's all about really reclaiming democracy. We need democratic decision-making regarding our economic choices. Every price in the marketplace right now is there because of the political choice to favor global traders and punish local traders and producers. So there's some very basic shifts we need to make, which I should also mention my new book, Local is Our Future, where I lay out those key steps that need much more elaboration, but it's an overview. And it's pretty simple what we need to do, but it will require consciousness among the voters of their need to get their head around that and to have a voice about it.
Well, thank you both. We're just at the end of our time. So maybe if I could just in Schumacher tradition, invite you to each offer just a short closing thought or reflection, and then we will call it a day. So maybe Richard, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I neglected to mention earlier, this is a word from our sponsor. My organization, Post Carbon Institute, has a daily updated website called resilience.org, which has thought pieces and news about all the things we've been talking about, from carbon farming to, you know, local governance to, you know, whole panoply. So it's a really interesting site to look at. I would recommend it. And then, there's so much good thinking and practice going on along all of these lines around the world. So it's great to celebrate it with the Schumacher Center and with Helena, and because we've all been doing this work for some time, and it's great to see younger people beginning to do this work, and not just people of European descent doing this work. You know, it's really becoming a truly global phenomenon. So just to celebrate the diversification and the rootsification of localization. That's a lot of isations there.
And I'd like to say that for me, Schumacher was a huge inspiration. And to sum up what I'm trying to say is that human scale is the systemic answer. And when people hear that from us, I get messages all the time that it's such a relief. They often say, it's particularly women in the West who will say, you put words to what I always felt that I couldn't articulate so clearly. We don't realize that there's vested interest trying to keep us on a path away from our nature, away from our human nature, away from nature. Same path taking us away. And that path is now telling us the problem is human nature. The problem is that we are so greedy, we are aggressive by nature, we're just pretty nasty, and we're very stupid as well, because we didn't do anything about climate change, even though we've been told again and again. And so now robots are going to be wiser and kinder than we are. That's a dominant narrative. Our narrative is no, it's human scale. That's what we need, and it's an inhuman scale and an inhuman pace that is taking us away from who we are. Once we see that, all the pieces fit together, and it's wonderful to have faith in us again and to know that we are actually made to want to be loved, to want to be connected, to want to help, to want to do meaningful things with our lives. So Schumacher, thank you very much for that very important message. Small is beautiful, small is necessary. And it is about human scale. And if you want to hear more about all our evidence for that, please come to localfutures.org.
Well, thank you both very much for taking the time. Very fascinating conversation. And thank you to all of you for joining in today.
Thank you for listening to the Schumacher Conversations. To hear more from visionary thinkers in the new economy movement and to discover 40 years worth of Schumacher lectures, visit our website at centerforneweconomics.org. You can strengthen our mission to bring about a just and sustainable global economy by making a donation at centerforneweconomics.org/donate or by purchasing pamphlets of your favorite lectures at centerforneweconomics.org/order-pamphlets.